you have a monster.
So let's start the afternoon session, the last session of this conference. Let me make a short announcement. For those of you who will stay here tomorrow and later, there will be several educational talks by Rob Schneider, by Alexander Soshenko, by Joran Gordon, and by Keith Cole. And you can get the detailed schedule packet and ask one of the organizers to give them who's responsible for those talks, and you are
so it
will be at PIMS and it will start at 9, so the familiarizers of this schedule. And the first talk of the afternoon session is by Laszlo Lovas from Microsoft Research. He will be talking about different functions in global information from local observation.
Talk is about. I would like to point out that the new results in this talk, which I, unless said otherwise, are joint results with Itai Beniamini. So the topic of this of my talk is I'd like to describe something which are discrete versions of analytic functions and some applications of them. And the excuse for this is mainly because that's a conference where there are analysts and combinatorialists present, and so I'm hoping to get some valuable suggestions as to how to go on in this direction. But it will turn out that some mysterious ways these analytic functions are also connected to critical phenomena in statistical mechanics, or seem to be, and so that's it's a better excuse of talking about this. Now, I have to talk, I want to start the talk with some topic that is actually very well known, although I don't... And people have used it in various contexts, but I don't know if there is any, I don't know any, like, book about them, but it's, and that's harmonic functions on graphs. Of course, they are connected to analytic functions, as we'll see. So, what's a harmonic function in a graph? We have a function defined on the vertices of the graph, and let's assume the graph is connected for... To exclude some trivial complications. And a function, we say that a function f, which is just any function on the vertices, is harmonic at a node I if its value at node I is equal to it's the average of the values in the, at the neighbors. So ni here is the set of neighbors of I, di is the degree of I. So it's harmonic at this point if it satisfies this. And we say that it has a pole at this point if it does not satisfy this. Now, of course, a constant function is harmonic, but if a function is non-constant, then it has to have at least two poles. Because if you look at the point where the function is, say, maximal, then if fi is maximum, then it can only be the average of its neighbors if all of them are also equal to fi, and so on, so eventually it has to be a constant function. So the maximum and the minimum points are poles. Now, there is a very simple remark that if you have any set, I should say non-empty set of vertices, and any function defined on this non-empty subset of the vertices, then there is a unique way of extending this so that it will be harmonic on the rest. Of course, if S is a singleton, then the extension will be the constant function, otherwise not necessarily.
Extending F not.
Sorry?
Extending F not.
F not, yeah, thank you, yeah. So extend this, the function from S to the whole. Now, I'll come back to this in a minute. Let me... Oops, I'm sorry. Okay, some technical problem. So we can define a harmonic function. The definition we can write in this form also. The sum over all neighbors J, Fj minus Fi is zero for every I wherever the function is harmonic. And this is equivalent to saying that if I introduce phi ij equal fj minus fi, then these values give a flow. That means that they satisfy the flow conditions there. And of course, if there's a pole of f, then it will have a source or sink. Then this sum will not be zero, so that means there's a source or sink. And elsewhere the flow condition is satisfied. And okay, a remark here is that this phi ij is a, if I look at phi ji, then I get the negative of it. So it's a kind of skew symmetric function on the edges. And we'll see others. That's just, it's a function on the oriented edges, and skew symmetric function. And we could generalize this by having some any kind of weights on the edges. That will come in a bit later on, this possibility. But so there are various nice examples of harmonic functions, and each of them I will use to show this extension theorem. So for example, suppose we have this set S here, which has some pre-assigned values, and I would like to know what's the value of the extension at this point V. And I can use a random walk to get this by starting a random walk at V and walking until I hit the set S, the set of green points, and let ZV be the point where I hit. That's a random point. And the expectation of the value of f. I mean, this is all very well known. I'm just summing up here. At least it's well known in the continuous version where the random walk would be a Brownian motion. But it extends to any graph. It doesn't really have any, doesn't need any other structure. And the most interesting special case is if there are only two specified points, and the value at one is zero, the other one is one, and then this FV can be thought of as the probability that a random walk from this V hits this point T before that point S. That's the function value of V.
So you assume the graph connected?
The graph is connected, that was assumed, yeah, it was assumed throughout.
In the first example, why does the value of the vertices at S matter in the
That should be F0, yeah. I suppose that F is given already there. Okay, could be F0, yeah, that's right. So this is one, it's a very easy exercise to show that this indeed gives a harmonic extension. The other one we can do is electrical networks. We just think of the graph as an electrical network with the edges having a resistance of 1, and then we keep, the FV will be the electrical potential, so we keep, say, this point at potential 1, this point at potential 0, but it could be any number of points where we fix the potential, and then the potential at V will be the value of this extension. And there is a third, again, physical thing, is that we sort of nail down the two points. We think of the edges as rubber bands of the same Hooke constant. So to stretch an edge to length T, you need a force of T. And then if you fix two of the points and let the rest find their equilibrium, again we get, so these two points are nailed down at point 0 and 1, and then the rest will find their position, and that position will give the harmonic extension of this function.
The edges are
all, if left alone, they all shrink to zero, and then we begin to stretch them, and the force is proportional to the length to be stretched, to which we stretch them. So this is another nice example of how to construct these harmonic functions. So the position of the nodes, and then there is a vocabulary which can translate various numbers between these three models. So, for example, if we are interested in the effective resistance between U and V, so this is now the electrical model, every edge has resistance 1, and now we measure what's the resistance of the whole structure between these two points, that's equal to 1 over 2m times the commute time between U and V, and it's also the reciprocal of the force that you would measure when you try to stretch this rubber band structure to length U. I think Prasad Tetali has all sorts of other nice connections, and many other people among these. So it's very nice. So just a quick... for example, there is the statement which is sometimes called the Rayleigh rule, that if you delete an edge of an electrical network, then the resistance goes up. And it's not so easy to prove it for the electrical resistance, but it's immediate from the third one. It's very easy to see it from the third formulation. Okay, now, so I won't talk more about harmonic functions. They are very useful, but this is a well-known topic. So now I would like to talk about analytic functions, and to introduce it, let me go back to this old paper from the 90s, from the 40s, by Brooks, Smith, Stone, and Todd. They were trying to construct... They were looking at the following problem. You have a rectangle, and you would like to dissect it into squares. And we look at all such dissections. Now, their goal was to... And eventually, the problem that they were trying to solve in that paper is that to construct a square which can be dissected into other squares which are all different. But as often happens, the tools that they developed for this are much more interesting than the result itself, which is a nice result, but it's sort of a recreational result. But the tools that they introduced here are really very, very interesting. And so here is how they proceed. So let's suppose that we have such a decomposition. And so they associate a graph with this. So to start with, we look at every edge of a square, horizontal edge, or rather, every segment, which is the union of one or more, every maximal segment, which is the union of one or more edges of squares. And we represent it with a point. So that point, this point represents here the lowest edge. Say this point represents this segment, and so on. And in their formulation, these points should be the midpoints of the segments, but the picture becomes very, very blurred, so I just shifted it to this side. Now we put in edges, and we put in an edge here between these two segments, which correspond to this edge and this edge, because there is a square which is attached to both. So, for example, this little square here is attached to this segment and that segment, so it will contribute an edge like this. So we get these. Now, this will give a graph and a little... we can give directions to the edges in the natural way, and it's not difficult to see that this graph will be a planar graph. So the edges if I put these points actually in the midpoints of the, then these edges will not intersect. The easiest way to see this is first think of these points as having a, this whole thing is a point, and then we can put in these edges just across the squares, and then we shrink those points to a single point, but of course the edges still don't intersect. Now we can also assign numbers to these edges, which is the size of the corresponding rectangle. So this edge will have a number 1, and number 3 is maybe this square. And then we can observe that these numbers form a flow, because if I look at this point, say here, there are two edges of weight 3 coming in, these two squares, and the 2 and the 3 and the 1 going out, which correspond to these 3 squares. And of course, they both, the incoming adds up to the same as the outgoing, namely the length of this square, of this segment. So these numbers satisfy the flow condition. But at the same time, if we assign, we can assign to each each point a number, which is, say, the distance from the top. And then these same numbers also are the differences between the two endpoints. That's because these are squares, so it's a flow because of the horizontal edges, and it's this difference rule you get because of the vertical edges are the same length as the horizontal edges. So what it means is that these blue numbers, if you remember, form a harmonic function on this graph because the differences form a flow, and that's equivalent to saying it's a harmonic function. So you get a harmonic function on this planar graph. Now, so here is just redrawn, but now you can also draw the dual graph. Of course, the same construction can work if you do the same construction between the two vertical. And then, if you think of it, there will be an edge corresponds to some square, and this edge, the corresponding, the same square contributes an edge to the other graph, and they will intersect each other originally in somewhere in the square, and then you of course, shrink the points to one point. So this is what's called a dual graph in graph theory, except for this little disturbance at the end that it's convenient to add an edge here which comes out here and goes back there, and another edge which goes out here comes back there. So together with those two edges, we get a pair of dual graphs on the sphere. And what's interesting is that these same, exactly the same numbers also give a flow on the dual graph. There's the only exception is this edge. This edge here has a different weight from this edge. Now, in the top, what they were aiming at where you had a square, this edge and this edge would have, this is the horizontal size of the big square and it's the vertical size of the big square. But even then, the rule, this would be a little bit different because these edges cross each other in a different direction than these. If you work out, the blue edge crosses the black edge from right to left, and except this one is crossed from left to right. So that edge is exceptional, but the other edges have this property. And so this gives the motivation to the following definition of analytic functions on a graph. So suppose we have a graph, and let's suppose the graph is embedded on some surface, let's assume it's orientable. That wouldn't be crucial, but let's assume it's orientable. Now, we define something which we call a rotation-free circulation. Now, circulation is just a flow which has no sources or sinks, so it just satisfies the flow condition at every point. So we have a function on the edges, and it has this property that the edges, I mean, you orient the edges, and that gives you the value of the function. If you reverse an edge, it just changes sign. And so I can write this as the sum of the flow values on all the edges going out of a point is zero. And then I add another condition. If you take any face, and you, now you reorient the edges so that they go around the face, so they are all oriented in the same direction around the face, then again, I assume that the flow values sum up to zero. So that corresponds to saying that on the dual graph, these same values on the edges of the dual graph would also constitute a flow. Now, this is such a flow, such a function, a rotation with circulation, can be considered the discrete analytic function. I'll come back to why, or actually, it's a more exact phrase, should be a discrete holomorphic form. And here are some people who need credit for their introduction. There is this paper that I just quoted, which implicitly, they never call it or introduce this notion, but implicitly they introduce this structure. It was actually explicitly introduced by Ferran and Duffin in the late 40s or early 50s, but only on the square lattice. And they served as some kind of, numerical analysis tools to that these functions could be exactly analyzed in or had the nice properties on a discrete lattice. And again, implicitly, Benjamin and Schramm used them in some work. And the explicit definition is in a recent paper, maybe a year old, by Merka, about which I will say a little bit more later. So, this is just a boring discrete analytic function. This is now supposed to be a torus, so this edge is the same as that edge going on there, and this edge is the same as this coming back here. And so, obviously, this is a discrete analytic function because the inflow is the same as the outflow for every point, and the rotation around each face is also zero. We'll see that on this particular graph, there is no other analytic flows, analytic functions, so this is not very interesting. But if we take a general graph, then the situation becomes trickier, and it took me a while to figure out that at least locally these numbers here correspond to a discrete analytic flow, because you really get the two kind of conditions. At least I hope I didn't make a mistake. So if you walk around this face, you get minus 2, 3, 9, minus 10, that adds up to 0, and so on. Now, if we again just think about it locally, we can assign values to the vertices because the condition that that it sums to 0 on every cycle means that if I start with 0 here and then I add 3 there so that the difference should be this 3, 12 there so that the difference should give this 9, and I have to put 2 here to get a 10 here, and then because the rotation freeness, if I go back here, I get the right value of 2, and I get back to 0 here. So locally, I can do this, of course, as soon as I go far enough so that I get a cycle which goes around, say, a handle of the surface, then then this will not work because I may get a contradiction. And similarly, I can assign values to the faces in the same way. So this 10 will be the difference between the values among the two faces. And in this case, of course, the flow condition at the point says that I can, if I go around that point, I don't get a contradiction. And again, once I go around a handle of the surface, I may get contradictions. So while I assume that these numbers exist consistently on the whole surface, I cannot integrate them. I don't assume that I can integrate them. So the points on the values on the vertices and the faces are not global. So, but locally we certainly have two harmonic functions here, because we saw that if the differences give a flow, that's a harmonic function, and that's true for both, one harmonic on the graph, one on the duograph. And we have this condition that the difference, say this difference, 12 minus 2, is equal to this difference, 13 minus 3, and that's exactly the Cauchy-Riemann equation. Or you can think of it as some kind of discrete version of the Cauchy-Riemann equation. So that's why we consider these as discrete analytic functions. I mean, there are two harmonic functions related by the Cauchy-Riemann equation. This picture just sort of shows the flows, and the only thing that I would like to point out is that if you actually do it, you see that these things tend to explode as you go away. So if you locally begin to construct these functions, then you get very large values if you go off. And that's also like behaves like analytic functions. They tend to grow fast. And I'll come back to this analogy. So there's a very easy description here, which in the continuous setting has a name. I think it's called the Hodge theorem. But here it's really just a few lines. So the whole, this R to the E consists of all functions defined on the edges, with the understanding this, this reference orientation. And I can decompose it into the direct sum of three mutually orthogonal subspaces. So first we have all circulations which are null homologous. That means that there is a trivial circulation that just go around the face, and then everything that they generate is a subspace A. And B is potentials. That means you assign some numbers to the vertices and you assign the differences to the edges. And that's orthogonal to A. And then if you think about it a little bit, the rotation-free circulations are exactly the orthogonal complement of those two, so the third orthogonal part. Now, it's easy to compute dimensions. The dimension of A is the number of faces minus 1. The dimension of B is the number of nodes minus 1. I mean, if you think about what's free here, it's, for example, here you can assign a number to each node, that's n degrees of freedom, but of course, if you shift them, you get the same differences, so that's where the minus 1 comes from. And so the dimension of rotation-free circulations is just by a direct computation twice the genus. So the just using Euler's formula. So, for example, if you remember still the torus and this grid on the torus the dimension is 2, and there were two free parameters, 5 and 17 there, so that implies that there is nothing else there on the torus. So this is the... Okay, so it's just the same theorem. Now, an analytic function cannot vanish on a large set. In fact, it cannot vanish on a non-zero analytic function, large meaning just any open set, any neighborhood of a point. So the question is any theorem like this for discrete analytic functions? And so here is a theorem. So F, suppose that F is such a non-zero rotation-free circulation. And suppose we look at the subgraph where it does not vanish, some subgraph. And then I look at the part where it vanishes, and I look at now a connected subgraph, suppose that U is a connected subgraph, such that this F vanishes on all edges of this subgraph and everything that goes out of it. So also on the edges that connect it to the outside. And I would like to say that this U is necessarily small. So here is the theorem. It says that this U, which somewhere here in the zero part, can necessarily be separated from the part where it does not vanish by a bounded number of points, 4g minus 3 points. So this is the theorem which sort of corresponds to that. So a small set here means a set which can be separated from what? Well, if you don't, if if you don't want to define G prime with respect to F, you can notice that F is that G prime must have some topologically non-trivial cycle because on the sphere there is no, on a topologically trivial, I mean the sphere, there is no discrete analytic function. So G is zero, so the dimension is 2G, which is zero. So it follows that part, which is out here, is topologically non-trivial. So I could say that it can be separated from some topologically non-trivial part by a small number, a bounded number of nodes. Now you may argue that this is not really, doesn't really mean that it's small. After all, this can be a huge number of points in here. But this is the right definition here. And in fact, if I take any part of the graph, which, say, planar part, to keep it simple, which can be separated by 2G minus 1 nodes, so it's almost the same. It's a 4G. I don't know where the truth is, but suppose it can be separated by 2G minus 1 nodes. Then I can do the following. Let's contract this part to a single point. I get a point here of degree 2G minus 1. And now, here is the observation. The dimension of all these rotation-free circulations is 2G, so there will be a non-zero member which is zero on all of these edges. And therefore, all I have to do is to unshrink it and keep it the same values outside and just put zeros there on the whole big part, and it's easy to check that this will be a rotation-free circulation, which is zero there. So basically this tells you that which connected pieces can be zero. They are those which can be separated from some topologically non-trivial part by about order of G points. I don't know where the truth is between 2G and 2G minus 1 and 4G minus 3. Okay. Now, let me sketch the proof of this theorem. So the theorem is that if a part cannot be separated, so if any connected piece where such a non-trivial rotation-free circulation vanishes can be separated from the rest by a small number of points. So suppose that G is graph with this orientation, fixed orientation, and suppose it's embedded in this surface. And for every face F, let AF mean the number of orientation changes that I count if I walk around the boundary of F. If I walk around the boundary, it may be zero, it's a non-negative number. And similarly, V is the number of orientation changes I count if I look at the edges that go out of the node V, and how many times the orientation changes. It can be in or out, so there will be some number of changes. And then there is a very simple identity which we get here, which is sum of AF minus 2 over all faces, but the sum of BV minus 2 over all vertices is 4G minus 4. Just elementary double counting. Okay. But now the theorem can be proved somehow like this. So suppose here is this part where this function is zero. And I assume now that there are no other zeros. That's an assumption just to make the proof simple. Without this, it's much longer. I mean, usually there will be, and the proof becomes much more complicated. But the idea is the same. So let's assume that this is all there. Everywhere else, it's non-zero. So again, I shrink this part to a single point, and what happened? Okay, don't need anything else. So I shrink this part to a single point, and now on this graph, I count these orientation changes. So I have to tell you how I orient these new edges, and I orient them alternatingly in and out. If the number is odd, I may lose one there, I may get two. So the observation is that if I take any other point, then there will be at least two orientation changes if I walk around it, because if all the edges would be oriented out, then that point would be a sink, but I actually have a circulation. It cannot. Every point that pushes anything out also has to receive something. So for every other point, the number of this BV is at least 2, and similarly for every face, the AV is at least 2, but for this point, I get an alternation. So I get ins and outs, changes about as many times as the degree. And so you substitute into the formula and get the bound. So, what is it? So you substitute in this formula, and everything here is non-negative, but there is one term here which is large, and that cannot be larger than this, and that's large as the number of these points. And so it's at most 4g minus 4, and you get 4g minus 3 if you do it. Yeah, if you do the computation properly. Okay, so let me mention another interesting topological property. Yeah, it's how much time I have? 10 minutes. Okay, fine. So let's look at an edge UV, and let chi UV denote the incidence vector of the edge UV. So it's 1 on the edge UV and 0 everywhere else. I mean, this is in the whole big space, the sum, the direct sum of A and B and C. But I can project it onto C, and I get a vector eta UV. And then the theorem says that if G is 0, then, of course, this eta UV is in C, but the dimension of C is 2G. So it's necessarily the projection is 0. But if G is non-zero, then this projection is never 0. And that has a, again, takes some work to prove this. But what is here is an interesting application of this. So let's look at this identity here, which is, I don't know if it's known. It's not terribly hard to prove that the squared length of this projection is actually the following: 1 minus. Now, what is this? It's in the graph G. I measure the effective resistance between the points U and V, and then I also measure the effective resistance in the dual graph between P and Q. And then the length of this is 1 minus the first resistance minus the second resistance. So in particular, we see that the sum of these two resistances is 1 for a planar graph. That more or less is known. I mean, that has been known. For any other surface, it's less than 1, and the difference is exactly this. This first thing is just says that it's a projection, so the coordinate corresponding to this edge itself is always positive. And that's not... it's a projection. So anyway, this is another interesting property of these guys. Now, here is the connection with criticality, and here I am not really so much at home, so I just quote 2 results from Merkel's paper. In fact, I don't even quote them. I quote them in quotation mark. So, first of all, to state them, we need to extend the definition to graphs with weighted edges. But that's very similar to how we did it for harmonic functions, except that now we need a weight, or call it length, L, assigned to each edge, and L star, which we think of assigned to the dual edge, but of course it's the same set. And so we have now this rotation-free circuit. Okay, so we have this function defined on the edges now, and then it's just the same definition, except that here I put in Lij. Actually, I think it's the reciprocal of Lij, if I want to be precise. I mean, if I want to follow his convention, so I divide by... I should. There's a minus 1 missing here. And for the other definition, I put in the Li J star. Now, what I have told so far would extend to this weighted version. But he defines this weighting to be critical if these two conditions are satisfied. Now, you don't have to really understand what these are. Let me try to just explain them in a picture. So we think of the L's as the length of the edges going out of, so this is a point I, so we think that the edges of segments of that length, and we think of the starred, Lij star, as the length of the dual edges which cross these edges. And then the two conditions together mean that the red edge and the black edge are orthogonal. I mean, you can locally arrange this picture so that the black edge and the red edge are orthogonal and bisect each other, which is equivalent to saying that we get here rhomboids if we connect each point to the centers of the faces around it. And so all these segments have the same length. At least locally, you have to have such a picture. Of course, it doesn't. It's a local condition. And he shows that if this weighting is critical, then there's a reasonable way to define the product of two analytic functions.
I mean, by the way, is the analytic function called an algebra?
Well, that's needed for it. I mean, without this condition, there's no notion of a product, but with this, you can. And I put the "and" only if in quotation mark because, I mean, in this case, there is a reasonable product, and that reasonable product doesn't, which I'm not going to define, but it's not quite straightforward to define. And he also proves that if we take the easing model with the interaction constants on this graph with interaction constants computable from these Lij star over Lij and take the Erx sine hyperbolic, then this easing model will be critical again if and only if this weighting is critical. Now, again, if and only if I had to put in quotation mark, because the easing model is defined if you have sort of an infinite grid, whereas this analytic functions are defined in a finite version, but there is a way to formulate this. So anyway, the same condition. I think the point is that you get exactly the same condition if you assume that it's some kind of periodic assignment of weights to the edges. And I can't really say more about this because it's outside my expertise. And he also only makes this as an observation, but I think it's a very interesting observation. So anyway, let me come to the other half of the title in the remaining 5 minutes? Three minutes? Okay. So here is a question. Okay, so here is a question. So we would like to observe a graph locally, a node or a neighborhood of a node, some kind of window, and there is some random process going on the graph, and we would like to derive some global properties of the graph. And the question, well, sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. Here is an example where you can. So the graph is some big graph embedded on a torus, and we are watching it in a small window where the condition on this window is exactly, but it's not a torus, it could be any surface. The condition on this window is exactly that it should not be so it's a window should not be separable from a non-trivial part of the graph by fewer than 2g minus 4 edges, 4g minus 3 edges. So, and then we define a random process on this graph, and the random process consists of three steps. In one step, a node wakes up, There will be only always weights on the edges. So some weights will be assigned to the edges. A node wakes up, observes the weights of the edges, and it says that, I am sending out too much. So it subtracts the same constant from all the edges going out so that it balances itself. And then every now and then, another node wakes up, a face wakes up, and it notices that it gets dizzy because there is more flow around one direction or the other. So again, it fixes it by adding the same constant to the edges around itself. And then there is a third time when an edge wakes up, and the edges are like the small kids, so they just try to spoil things, so they add randomly one to the edge or subtract where they are. And now, without the edge excitations, the weighting would converge to a smooth flow. So the dimension of smooth flows is 2g, but now here comes the crucial application of our theorem, that if you view these smooth flows only in this small window that you have, the dimension is still 2g because the restriction, as I sketched the proof, is non-degenerate. And so without the edge excitations, I would see, if they occur very randomly, then if I look every now and then at this window, what I see is a random vector from a 2G dimensional subspace. And then from here on, it's just some statistical work to recreate, to get rid of the errors and so on, and to determine the dimension of this space I am seeing, and that gives me the genus. So the result finally is that if P, which is the probability, this is the frequency by which the edges wake up, so the noise, is low enough, then some polynomial for some absolute constant C, then in a polynomial number of steps we can find out this way the genus of the whole graph by looking at this bounded size window. And finally, I would just like to mention that there are sort of two generic questions that one can ask. One is, are there other examples of this thing that you try to gain global information by observing something locally? And there's a classical question here, which is that, can you hear the shape of a drum? It's sort of the same ballpark, but this is now a discrete version of this. And the other question is concerning these discrete analytic functions, which other properties of analytic functions have sort of natural and useful discrete analogs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
This is Philip. The vanishing, I mean, if you look more quantitatively, then you would think of discrete analog terms of Cartan's theorem, which tells you that the set where an analytic function is less than epsilon is going to have a measure which is less than, some constant, some kind of more quantitative form is being small.
I was thinking about this. Trouble is that here it's really, I have to find the right form because that part which you cut off may be very large, already where it's zero. So it's not just the number of nodes, it's some kind of connectivity with the rest of the graph that
may have to do with
matters.
The graph, of course, right?
Yeah, so.
Nice,
maybe you could, yeah. So, yeah, we thought a little bit about that, but haven't gotten the right formulation. But I think that could be.
More questions? So let's thank Mr. Gaben. So next topic is Bharati Kannan.